An interactive movie night featuring the 2024 movie adaptation of the hit musical Wicked as the final event of the Summer at the Center. So follow the yellow brick road to Emerald City, also known as Andrews Hall, and join fellow musical theater fans for a night singing from one of the most popular shows in Broadway history. You don't need to be a Broadway star or even know the lyrics. The movie rolls along as any film would, but every time the actors begin singing, the lyrics light up under the singers so that the audience may sing along. The Wicked Movie Sing Along will screen in Andrews Hall at the Sonoma Community Center on Thursday, July 31st. Doors open at 6 p.m. The film starts at 6:30. All proceeds benefit programs at the center. Tickets are available online. Visit SonomaCommunityCenter.org and be changed for good.
The following show is brought to you in part by
APS Packaging and Automation. APS automates bottling lines for wine and spirits. They offer engineering, project management, installation, commissioning, and after-sales service. For more information, visit their website at aps-pack.com or call 707-757-7725.
Cottages of Napa Valley, renting private cottages in the heart of Napa wine country, offering 8 individual historic rentals to choose from, nestled along cobbled pathways under mature trees with amenities and concierge services. For reservations and information, napacottages.com or call 707-252-7810.
Transcendence Theater Company's Broadway Under the Stars, presenting Broadway's best night ever in the Field of Dreams, June 12th through the 22nd, featuring iconic songs and dance numbers from more than 25 Broadway musicals. Tickets at bestnightever.org or call 877-424-1414.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KSVY 91.3 FM in Sonoma, streaming at ksvy.org. And it's time for Strictly Business, the radio show that's all about business in Sonoma County, the things that affect it, and the people who make it happen. My name is Scott Hunter, and I'm here with our host, Kip Altman, for today's show. Hello, Kip.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you very much. And welcome, everybody, to KSVY, the voice of Sonoma Valley. For 23 years, and we try to be or give voice to business in Sonoma Valley, Sonoma County, Northern California, wherever we can find it. We've been doing this for 3 years and learning every time we have a guest who's kind enough to join us. And today is no exception to that. Today we're going to be talking about food service and the restaurant business. For those of us who enjoy going out to dine, it's a fun thing to do. For those who provide that dining, you could fool me if it looks like fun. But we're going to talk to someone who whose life has been spent doing that. Let me just tell you that July 21, a week from today, is National Junk Food Day. The relevance of that is not so great, but today we're going to be talking about the exact opposite of that, fine dining. And the question I ask myself is, why isn't there a National Fine Dining Day? And there isn't. National Junk Food Day. What a waste, it would seem. Anyway, our guest today is Doug Keen. He is a 32-year veteran of the restaurant industry, a 23-year resident of Sonoma County, and the originator of fine dining in Sonoma County. dating back 20 years. Now, what does fine dining mean? The highest of restaurant quality you can imagine, coast to coast, country to country. That's what fine dining means. It's not it can be casual, but it's superb food and superb preparation. My words, not Doug's. He is a Michelin star awarded chef and co-owner of Cyrus Restaurant in Geyserville, formerly in Healdsburg. And he is also the author of a new book in 2025 about his life in this pretty damn tough business called Culinary Leverage, A Journey Through the Heat. Let me just say there are only 8 Michelin-starred restaurants in the North Bay, only 3 in Sonoma County, and Doug Keene was the first. At one point, he operated 3 restaurants and employed 100 people. He's been doing this, as I said, for about 21 years. He had 8 restaurant openings, 9 restaurants total, and lots of employees to taken care of. So, Doug, you know, welcome to Strictly Business. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time and to talk about your life in this field, in this industry, and of course, your book.
Thanks for having me. It's my honor.
By the way, when Doug refers to heat in this book, in my opinion, he's not just referring to heat in the kitchen. He's referring to the heat of battle. This guy has both had to compete in kitchens, in courtrooms. It's not for the faint of heart, as Doug will relate in his book. Doug, I just want to first of all thank you for being so gracious to join us, because I know when I cornered you at the Sonoma Valley's Authors Festival in May, you were immediately receptive to the idea of joining us on this program, and I really did appreciate that.
I'm always happy to talk. I am. Especially about stuff like this. And you're local, so that's great. So, no, thanks for asking me to be here.
And also of great importance to Scott and me, we appreciate your devotion to the canine species. We do the same.
Yeah.
I want to pay my highest compliments, by the way, to Maxie for her wonderful flexibility of living with you in Dearborn, Ithaca, New York, third floor studio walk up at 74th and York. I lived in New York for 20 years at 90th and East End Avenue, so I know exactly where you were. Also loved reading about Dolly, Maxie, Lola, Milo, Finn, Cash, Piglet, Roxy, and Yuki, your elephant friend.
Yuki. she was a beautiful soul. Well, there is. I think Yuki's still alive, actually.
And Yuki is an elephant, unlike the canine species. But Doug, to his credit, has been devoted to animals all his life and to their salvation and rehabilitation oftentimes. So we really do appreciate.
I'm just paying back what they gave me.
Amen to that. Also, we wanted to offer congratulations to your business partner of 26 years, Nick Payton, for being named the 2025 Service Award winner by Michelin Guide California. That's a nice honor for him.
Yeah, I mean, that was long overdue. Nick is, without a doubt, the best in the business. For those that date back to my years, there's a gentleman by the name of Cirio Maccioni in New York City at Le Cirque, who was a famous maitre d'. And everyone used to ask me why Nick and I teamed up. I said, because Cirio was busy. And he was the best guy that was available. And Nick is that good. Michelin probably should have recognized him years ago, but I guess they get some things right eventually. And he should be recognized by everyone for not just as good as he is in the front of house and as good as he is with staff, but just what a great human being he is.
And you guys have been doing this for 26 years, I think, right? So it's
we actually met before that. We actually met in 1991 when I was a little whippersnapper doing a summer internship at the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco out of Cornell, and then stayed in touch over the years. And then when I moved back here, we opened Gary Danko's together. He was a partner, and I was the opening sous chef. So we started working together then, and I realized very quickly. I was always very close with him, but I realized very quickly that was not a match made in heaven any longer, because Gary was a piece of work, and I was able to leave. Nick had to stick around and make sure the investment was covered by the people he had raised money from. But I reached out to him before I left and said, you're the guy I would like to work with. I'd like to have a front house partner that I never had to worry about the front, and you don't have to worry about the back. And we didn't look back. He called me one day and had me look at a kitchen. I thought I was actually looking at it for another chef that he was going to possibly work with. And I said, yeah, this is a kitchen that I'll work in, but your buddy's never going to work in this. And he said, this is for you. I'm like, us? What do you mean? I'm like, okay, I thought you were doing something. And then we started. It wasn't the kitchen we decided on, but we opened up. We actually started the first Cyrus first, but it took so long that we opened up a place in St. Helena called Market to keep it out. We needed a job. So we kept ourselves busy for a while Cyrus got opened, and then we sold Market to one of our employees there, Eduardo, who still owns it. And Nick and I never looked back. We've been working together, like you said, for 26 years.
And Doug, I know that you're pretty darn honest about your opinion about people, including those in St. Helena. who were not the most.
Some of those in St. Helena. Okay. I just didn't have Nick actually enjoyed some of his time, or his wife enjoyed their time in St. Helena personally. I did not. No, I found it the most entitled city in North America. I still stick with that. But there's some good people over there, and they're the ones who are probably cringing when I say that because they think I'm talking about them. And I'm not. It's just a sense of entitlement that the haves don't want to have the have-nots have anything. But it is what it is. I love Sonoma. We grow a lot of Napa Valley's food over here, so they can thank us for that.
I have to admit, after reading your book, I thought to myself, geez, it's amazing that you were, A, able to sit down and even talk to us, B, that you're still in this business, because between startup efforts, you suffered depression, you had a brain tumor, you've had several lawsuits to deal with, you've had your best friend dogs who have had to leave, and I thought, gee, God almighty, this guy, you have spent a lot of time dealing with things that anyone would prefer not to deal with, which are not psychologically uplifting.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I have a really good memory. And so I think everyone has things in their life that they deal with, right? And we all have our tragedies, our ups, our downs. I just was able to remember a lot of them vividly, and so I was able to write about it. I think my life isn't that different. Yeah, maybe, not a lot of people get a brain tumor, but a lot do. And I just thought it was documented a lot of why I wrote what I wrote. There was a downtime during COVID that there was a lot of time to sit and write. And I was going through a lot of depression then, a lot of maybe even manic episodes of highs and lows of getting this restaurant going and figure out who I really was. And it felt very cathartic to write a lot of this, to relive some of the ugly moments and actually paint a picture of why I had gotten to the spot where I thought I was broken. Where I was broken. Why I got there is actually what I wanted to write about. And it actually felt really good to heal it. I went through some obviously more intense times during that process that I document. But it really was, I don't think my story is that special. I just think I was able to remember it and I wanted to get it out. It felt good. I honestly didn't know if I was going to ever sell this book when I wrote it. I thought maybe I'd self-publish, maybe I'd never do it, maybe I'd just be a diary and I'd give it to, my niece or nephews when I left this earth. But it did, and when it did sell, I finally realized, oh shit, people are going to read some of this stuff. And it wasn't the people that I didn't know, it was actually the people that I knew that bothered me the most, because a lot of them, they didn't know it. They lived through this with me, but didn't know what was going on. And that's probably, it's definitely my fault. I wasn't able to talk about a lot of it. Maybe I would have been better. But I remember the time I handed the book to Nick, finally, he'd been asking for it. And I was kind of holding off. And there's actually Drew, who also works there. I gave them both an electronic copy, I believe. And they both came in like the next weekend or the days after, and I was just like, whoa, and it was pretty heavy. I found time, and I'm glad I did it, and I'm really proud of it too.
And you should be. I should point out that the heart of the book, and as I understand it, is not to dwell on the obstacles and challenges that you obviously faced, although it's a big part of the story. But most important is your total distaste and disgust with the outdated mode of business in which restaurants usually compete. It's relatively inhumane, it seems, and it's you have a new way of doing it, which is what Cyrus became all about. And to your credit, Harvard Business School undertook a bit of a case study on whether your model, what your model is, and hopefully whether it works, which we obviously want to ask you about.
You're right. It was. That the purpose of the book, and I didn't realize it when I started the book, was actually to tell the story of the new Cyrus. That was it as to how to get there, because you want to uplift people and give them a path forward. But yeah, dysfunctional, toxic are all the words that I would describe this industry. You asked in the beginning, I don't see how it's fun for you to eat out. I don't see how it's fun to do this work. I beg to disagree with you, to differ. It is really fun to do this work in a way. There's rewards that come from this work that you can't get in any other business. You know, my dad was an attorney. My mom ran a business, a beauty salon. I couldn't imagine doing either of those. Maybe the beauty salon more, because you could see your clients right away. But there is an immediate gratification. There is an immediate gratification to cooking someone a meal, whether it be in your house or in a restaurant, and getting to see that reaction, that joy, that celebration of whatever they're celebrating with their loved ones, or even just to lift them up a little bit from a bad day. That's an amazing reward. And that was part of the reason I got into it. Because I got the high, the endorphins off of making people happy and being able to accomplish something. Like I mentioned in the book, cutting grass and digging ditches was fun because I could actually see the work and the reward right away. But this is very much like that. And so you kind of get addicted to that. And that is fun. It's hard and it's dysfunctional and it broke me and it broke a lot of people. But yeah, it's a little inhumane. At least it doesn't have to be, I don't think. At least that's what we're trying to prove in our corner of the world. And Harvard Business School, yeah, they did actually do a full case study. They're teaching it at Harvard. Professor Jim Heskett, who's kind of the master of case studies there. And that was actually, that was pretty highlight for him to come out here for a number of weeks and study us and interview everybody.
Well, you know, it strikes me as such a conflict, a personal internal conflict, in the sense that I probably should take back what I said about how can it be fun. I'm sure for someone who is as artistic and creative as you are, I'm sure it is fun. And yet the challenge of meeting obvious deadlines nightly and having people be pleased and happy with what they enjoy. I know that you have a distaste for people who think they're food critics, as they appear on Yelp and other places where they don't know a damn thing about what they're talking about. But you get to know whether
you liked it or not. Absolutely, like you can have any. I just didn't like it. It didn't taste good to me, or it's too, or whatever. But if you come in, you need to have some chops to criticize, to actually get specific and criticize. Say, oh, that sauce wasn't right, or whatever. They should have done this, that, the other thing. No, you definitely get your right to an opinion. It's your money. You get your right to say, I'm not going back there. But like to get in there and act like you know what you're talking about, and try to credibly criticize, that's what bothers me. You know, and there's a lot of critics that don't actually have those chops either.
And by the way,
I
was going to say, speaking of critics, one of the best parts of the book I thought was when you returned to Cornell as a guest speaker, having achieved stars from everybody, from Michelin, from the Chronicle, from Chef of the Year, Esquire, James Beard, and the dean of the school when you were there thought you were underperforming and maybe you shouldn't be here. And you, and I thought the way you expressed, you understated your presentation. You invited a dear friend who couldn't show up. I thought that was really a wonderful in your face moment.
You know, it was Irish Alzheimer's. We forget everything but the grudge, and I definitely have that gene.
It's roughly 20 past the hour, and it's time for a station break. You're listening to Strictly Business, and we'll be right back.
You've been listening to Strictly Business, sponsored by
APS Packaging and Automation. APS automates bottling lines for wine and spirits. For more information, visit their website at aps-pack.com or call 707-757-7725. Cottages of Napa Valley, renting private cottages in the heart of Napa wine country. For reservations and information, napacottages.com or call 707-252-7810.
Transcendence Theater Company's Broadway Under the Stars, presenting Broadway's best night ever in the Field of Dreams, June 12th through the 22nd. Tickets at bestnightever.org or call 877-424-1414.
Programming for KSVY is brought to you in part by The Schoen Group, located in beautiful downtown Sonoma. SchoenGroup.com. This health moment is brought to you in part by Sonoma Valley Hospital.
Season with herbs instead of salt. Try curbing your salt intake by seasoning your foods with fresh or dried herbs. They're versatile and can spice up any dish by adding flavor without the sodium. If you absolutely need some salt, try reducing the amount and use half, or just adding a little pinch.
July 12th through the 27th, it's the Valley of the Moon Music Festival, voted Best Chamber Music Festival in the Bay Area by San Francisco Classical Voice Readers, is Sonoma's premier destination for world-class classical music. Now in its 11th season, Liaisons. Enjoy inspiring weekend concerts Saturdays and Sundays at 4 p.m. at the Hanna Center Auditorium, plus intimate al fresco performances on weeknights at La Luz Center and Buena Vista Winery. And don't miss the free kids and family concert. There's something for everyone. Tickets are available. Visit valleyofthemoonmusicfestival.org or email info@valleyofthemoonmusicfestival.org for any other questions or information.
And now back to Strictly Business.
And we're back. You're listening to Strictly Business with our host, Kip Altman, and today's guest, Doug Keene, who's the chef and co-owner of Cyrus Restaurant up in Geyserville.
Thank you, Scott. And Doug, thank you again for joining us today. Doug is an award-winning chef and owner of Cyrus, Cyrus 2.0, it's called, the second incarnation of a fine restaurant. And he is also the author of Culinary Leverage, Journey Through the Heat. And you read this book and you realize he's not kidding. There's a lot of heat in this book. It's not just in the kitchen. It's a real business battle to succeed, unfortunately. You know, Doug, one of the questions you ask in this book, which I certainly understand, is why were there some people who simply didn't want you to succeed? I would say that I know you had to indulge in lawsuits, and obviously you saw things one way and the opposite side saw things another way. But even along the way, there are some people who, you know, I remember you said your next-door neighbor who had a food company in Healdsburg said, I hope you don't make it. I hope you're out of business soon. What the heck is the point of that? Why? Why do you think?
Ego. Ego, yeah. So the guy that wanted me to go out of business, the lawsuits were all ego too. And on this side of it, not backing down and standing up to bullies, and it's a genetic flaw that I probably have. It's like, wait a minute, I'll do it for myself and I'll do it for people that I loved. It's just like, no, I'm going to prove a point, especially when you're absolutely dead right. And I knew I was in all of those lawsuits. They were just someone with a lot of money trying to bend us to their will. And it was just like, and it wasn't to my benefit to do it either. It's like, so that was the guy that told me we want to go out of business. He was pissed because he picked a location that was hidden by our restaurant and it wasn't our fault. And he wasn't getting the walk-in traffic, but he took it full knowing. And he just kept trying to cut down our property. And, you know, we almost came to blows one day about it. And he was just bitter. He wasn't doing well. And he was circling the wagons. But, I mean, there's people that wrote notes, I think I told about to the Shimo before we opened, that just wanted us to fail too. You know, at some point people get success, and at that point we had three restaurants, and people are jealous of success, and they don't realize that, you know, they don't know you personally. They don't know that you do a bunch of good. You hire a bunch of local people. You try to do the best for everyone. They're just bitter at success sometimes, and that's okay. I don't let it bother me much anymore. I'm pretty happy with my place in this world.
The other thing I don't understand is you achieved notoriety very quickly. After you started Cyrus, and I would have thought that those who became combatants, the owners of the hotel in Healdsburg, the subsequent owner of the hotel in Healdsburg, the property owner in Geyserville, how could they not have benefited from your notoriety, the restaurant's reputation, the number of people who are going to be coming to Healdsburg to enjoy what you do, who would then become familiar with that hotel, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, how did they not benefit from your success? I didn't quite understand.
The first owner of the hotel could have totally benefited from our success. He couldn't help himself despite himself. They didn't know how to run the business. We would have totally worked with them. He circled the wagons, and then it was a Hatfield-McCoy situation. But there is even chance. There was two or three lawsuits with him. And there was a chance to bury the hatchet many times, but he just couldn't do it. And we were successful. Like we needed nothing at that point. They had a 12 room or 16 room hotel that had two people a night at the most. And they just were so arrogant that they couldn't get over themselves to be like, we need to work with these guys. We would have totally worked with them. The second one,
that one I believe is ego in a big way.
Yeah. Ego. But honestly, you know, yes, it started from ego for sure. But, you know, Bill was easy to deal with in the end. He didn't want to fight at the end. Yeah. He just wanted to, like, this doesn't make any sense. I'm right. So we either give you a check or you give us a check. He was easier for him to write a check.
Right.
And we weren't going to be able to get along at that point. That one was an easy settlement, to be honest. Like, that one wasn't as brutal. I mean, the time and the toll it took was fine, but we did really well in that settlement, and it was the obvious choice.
Right.
I mean, I think the mediator walked into the room like within about 5 minutes after separating us in the, you know, the little kumbaya in the beginning that no one wanted to be at. And he said, okay, we need a divorce here, and we got to figure out who's buying who out. And we're like, yep, that you got it, man. He was good. And then went back and forth for a couple hours, and he's like, all right, here's your check.
And good for you keeping the Cyrus name. That was obviously important.
Didn't want it. Bill even said, I don't have any use for Michelin stars or this in one of his depositions. He's like, I don't want any of this stuff. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, we're different things. The last one was 100% pure ego, and that was just spite. And, yeah, didn't care about whether it helped the community or our success. Just it was pure spite. Couldn't see in front of his face. So, and, you know, important for me was to actually have that one publicized because – I could have had a, you know, we got an injunction in that one, which is how strong our case was. The judge actually said, yeah, you're going to win this. Let's stop all this nonsense now. And the injunctions are almost impossible to get because judges hate to rule before the whole thing's done. But that one was, it was just someone wanted to hurt us and it didn't make any sense. And so I wanted to publicize it so that everyone knew it wasn't us. We were not the crazy ones who can't get along with any landlord. It was the fact that this was so insanely crazy. We had a whole slew of investors that are lawyers that looked at it before we did anything, and they're like, "This is ridiculous. It's so black and white." And so we were just, "All right." I think the idea was to break us, make us spend a bunch of money, and make us go out of business. And then I can't say that for a fact, but that was my instinct. Was like, we put a ton of money into this business, and he could have gotten it back and sold it to someone else or leased it to someone else as a fully functioning restaurant. We just, you know, we had too strong of a team around us.
Well, not to dwell on the legal problems. I mean, they clearly were a big part of your life, sadly, and obviously a terrible distraction as well from what you're in business for.
Yeah. And waste of time.
And the point of getting away from that is again the purpose of your book and the title of your book, Culinary Leverage, was when you realized after being awarded stars from so many sources, the Chronicle, Michelin, of course, was that you, your notoriety brought leverage with it, which you could do good things with. That was an impressive way to look at your own, frankly, ego satisfaction with being recognized for your competence. So the title of the book is really about how you could leverage your own culinary stardom, if you will, to do good things for the industry, for the people who work for you, people who work around you, the customers who come there, and that was impressive. I thought that was an impressive way to look at it.
To make it more equitable, the whole experience. You know, there was a point in time where we took care of guests and tried to take care of employees, but then that kind of got skewed, and it became more about like the celebrity of the chef and the ego and the awards and the stars, and then you kind of lose focus of the guests, and you definitely lose focus. You care more about likes and retweets or whatever they are, reposts, and then you do the guests and the employees, and the employees got pushed way to the back, you know. And so it was like, I mean, it's not just an altruistic feeling, it's like it hurts the business model when you have super high turnover. It's not good for the business. Like, you don't make a turnover costs money. Yeah, you're getting rid of someone, but you're replacing them, or you're paying overtime to cover that stuff, and you're not getting as good of a job. So it's just like all common sense points to like, wait, let's stop that kind of bleeding, and let's just do it with less people and pay them a lot better and treat them better. It was kind of common sense to me. And that's the funny part. If you read the Harvard Business Study by Professor Heskett, he kind of says like that's a lot of ways companies look at it. It's just very different in the restaurant industry because it's always about like running on that thin, thin line and bleeding it and having as many people as you, as many bodies as you can paid as little as possible. Well, that's just like, that's a recipe for disaster. So that's how we looked at it differently and decided that we wanted to pay people really well or as well as we could right now. And treat them as well as we can and give them a life and let them know they're just as important. We make a lot of decisions here for better or worse for the bottom line that affect the employees. Like we take a week off in the summer. It's 4th of July week. We might be able to be busier. We've actually debated it this year when business isn't as great up here this year. And we've debated like maybe we shouldn't be closed that week because we could have better business. But to me, it's like really important like that people get a holiday off. Because we always work holidays and weekends, and so it's just like this is a normal person's holiday. So we just stuck to it. We closed for 3 weeks in the winter, and everyone gets that off too. It's just important to me. And sometimes we could probably make more money, but I think in the long run, I think it's going to benefit us. You know, it's the story is still being written, right?
Yeah, amen. I know that you know the from the compensation perspective in the kitchen. I know you know this firsthand from the story you told about. I think it was at Les Panas when you. We're told you're going to be paid $500 a month, and you said, I can't live with that.
Picholine.
And you said, I need $600 a month.
Brennan.
Yeah. $600 a month. I said, no dice.
How can, I literally couldn't do rent and health insurance, let alone eat.
And you know, again, you know this firsthand, that's the, from the dysfunction you saw, that tends to be a dominant theme in kitchens, high-end, high-pressure kitchens?
Completely. And the trade-off is, you know, that they're working for someone who going to teach them things and going to put on your resume, you're going to better yourselves. And part of that is definitely true. And I benefited from working for free in a lot of places in New York, doing my stages because it was good for me. That was a choice, though. You still have to live. And so, yeah, it is. But the model is just like it just keeps going. When you grow up in the business, it's like when you grow up in an abusive kitchen, just from like a screaming standpoint, you only know how to treat you only know how to manage and run that way. It's until you see some different way, you're like, oh wow, it doesn't have to be like this. Can you do it? So I think that when you like see the business and you're used to working for dirt cheap, and you're like, they should work for dirt cheap. You know, at the first Cyrus, there was a time where we were paying people, I don't remember what it was, 13, 15 bucks. It was a pretty good wage. It was like close to a living wage technically. But they were all coming in 2 hours early on their own time. And that was just kind of a rule of the industry. You always showed up an hour or two early to do your prep and you didn't clock in. And that scared the bejesus out of me because like places get sued eventually. It doesn't even take someone being angry. It just takes someone finding out about it. So instead of that time, because I was still on the hamster wheel, instead of thinking about how can we make this better, I was like, all right, let's actually lower everyone to minimum wage and pay them for every hour that they're here, including the overtime. That way we're covered. It made a lot of sense to me at the time. And then I look back at it like, wait, I missed it. I actually missed it. What I should have done is paid everyone a bunch more and figure out how to re-engineer it. But it's really hard when you're in the middle of the hamster wheel without taking a break from it to actually see some light.
Well, and again, you essentially implemented your new model of management with Cyrus 2.0. The first Cyrus you had, if my numbers are correct, I believe you had 56 seats and did about 85 dinners or covers per night.
Yes, sir.
With a staff of 50. And
yes, sir.
The new Cyrus in Geyserville, you serve about 36 covers a night with a staff of 15. So you're
We do. We actually, when we first opened, we did 3 seatings a night. And then we were 5 days. And one of our goals was to get to 4-day work weeks. That was just a lofty goal, an aspirational goal. We didn't know how we were going to do it. But very early on, my pastry chef, we had a private dining room one night of 12 people. And I jokingly said, we should do this every night. Like, let's have another seating. And I was joking because they all were worried about that. And Josh, my pastry chef, said, well, chef, if we did it 4 nights a week, we could actually close another day and everyone could have 3 days off. And Nick and I like looked at each other and we're like, whoa. You know, and so we did it. And the interesting thing was one of my investors actually said, oh, that's great. You'll save 20% on labor. I was like, no, that's not the idea. I want to pay them the same amount and give them an extra day off. And I said, it's life changing. And it has been. It's one of the best things we've done. And when the business isn't there, it hurts. right? When we don't sell four seatings every night, it's harder. When you're selling everything, it's great, but you still have to kind of stick to that. But the philosophy of 4-day work weeks is something that I don't know if I'd ever want to go back to, especially for how hard these guys work. Plus, you're also giving up all your weekends.
And
that's part of the game.
That's funny, the investor's perspective. It's great labor cost reduction. Great idea.
Yeah, they get it. I mean, they invest in this because it was a different model, but you also can't help. If you're a business person, you can't help with thinking like that. So I just said, no, that's not what we're doing here, you know?
I couldn't help but wonder also, and this is a personal thing, obviously, it's your business. What does a share in a business like yours cost? What do you ask for to sell one share to an investor? What do you want from that investor?
We sold shares at $100,000 here.
$100,000.
The first Cyrus, we did $25,000 shares. Here we did $100,000, just because it was a bigger raise.
And what size returns do investors want, and in what period of time?
That's a loaded question. In the means of, I actually write about it. Most people, when you do investments, you can take a loan out, right, from a bank, and then you got interest and payments that are happening no matter what. So COVID hits, and you got a big loan out. That's why everyone went belly up, because there's no cash. Cash dries up quickly. So we have always raised private money and basically promised a certain percentage. And we incentivize ourselves by having a really small percentage in the beginning. And then when we pay back the investment, there's a little watershed moment or waterfall moment where we actually start making more money. So we're incentivized to pay them back. So we're not incentivized to sit on a bunch of money. We're incentivized to distribute. We don't make money until they make money. Normally, the long way to answer your question, people don't look for a return on their investments in restaurants. They think it's just a favor. They're helping out. They want to get tables. They want to help some people open the restaurant. They think it's cool for the community. They're writing off their $25,000 investment for the most part. And that bums me out, because what it means is, unless you got your name in the paper and on TV and know a bunch of really, really wealthy people who you've cooked for, it's going to be really hard to get investment funds for a restaurant. There's a lot of great cooks out there who could probably have some wonderful restaurants. So, 10% is considered a good month in a restaurant, or it was. But that's not really a healthy industry. You don't make investments for 10% on the bottom line. We've been trying to hit 20 to 25% is at a minimum. We've done pretty well. This has been a tougher year for sure, just because business is slower up in Sonoma County. But there's no expectation of money, but they also don't want to be putting in money.
By the way, is it slower? Is the business in Sonoma County slower because of the cyclicality in the wine industry itself? People are drinking less wine, and therefore they're less tastings and less ordering of bottles and the whole thing, which of course is going to hurt your bottom line too, right?
There's less visits to wineries for sure up here. There is less visits to San Francisco. San Francisco tourism was way down, as well as the conferences, and Sonoma and Napa both would score a lot of extra visits. Like, people would book a conference and then come up here for the weekends. And that kind of dried up quite a bit. But the wineries are the big driving business up here. Obviously, it's a huge part of our economy up here. So when the wineries go down, and they were flying high after COVID, they sold a ton of wine. The people were dying to come up here, and then just kind of stopped. I think people also went to Europe for a little bit. And then there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in politics, and people are uneasy about what's going on. And so I think that has actually affected it. But yeah, the wineries bounce back. It'll come back to normal.
In terms of the, I want to use the word ownership structure, but that's not really what I mean, because that would, to me, be investors versus management. But the structure of the actual physical structure of the restaurant itself. I mean, you found yourself in challenging situations because you were always the lessee on your property. You were not the owner. Yeah. I may be mistaken, but I guess Tom Keller owns French Laundry Building, and the family over here owns On Close, the one that just got 2 stars here in Sonoma. They own that building. So if you own the building you're operating in, obviously you're probably in better shape than if you're a lessee.
Absolutely. I mean, there's for a number of reasons. One, you can withhold some bad months or down periods, but two, you actually have an asset. A restaurant really, the restaurant has a lease and they have some equipment that you put a $10,000 piece of equipment in, it immediately becomes worth $1,000 the second you turn it on. So you have nothing to sell at the end of a lease. You have a lease and you have a liquor license. And that's really your only asset. Everything else is broken up equipment and stuff like that. And so to own your building is absolutely a huge game changer. We are lucky enough to have partnered with some people that bought the building from our little old nemesis there. And we've had a great relationship with them. And we're basically partners in the property. And they just want to see our success. It's kind of like a dream come true.
Wonderful. It's 40 past the hour, and we need to take a short break. You're listening to Strictly Business, and we'll be right back.
You've been listening to Strictly Business, sponsored by
APS Packaging and Automation. APS automates bottling lines for wine and spirits. For more information, visit their website at aps-pack.com or call 707-757-7725. Cottages of Napa Valley, renting private cottages in the heart of Napa wine country. For reservations and information, napacottages.com or call 707-252-7810.
Transcendence Theater Company's Broadway Under the Stars, presenting Broadway's best night ever in the Field of Dreams, June 12th through the 22nd. Tickets at bestnightever.org or call 877-424-1414.
Programming for KSVY is brought to you in part by The Schoen Group, located in beautiful downtown Sonoma. SchoenGroup.com. This health moment is brought to you in part by Sonoma Valley Hospital.
Restful sleep has many health benefits. It helps learning and memory and reduces risks for most chronic disease and obesity. Most adults acquire 7 to 9 hours of sleep regardless of age. Things that help us sleep better at night include exercise during the day, but not just before bed. Having a calm, dark bedroom with clean, comfortable bedding and learning to relax and let go of the stress each evening. We'll sleep better if we don't eat 2 to 3 hours before bedtime, avoid caffeine later in the day, as well as alcohol and tobacco.
Calling all aspiring teen filmmakers. The submission period for Sonoma County Library's 5th annual Teen Film Festival is now open, offering young creators the chance to share their stories on the big screen and win prizes. Submissions will be accepted through August 15th. All Sonoma County teens in grades 7 through 12 are invited to submit an original film up to 6 minutes long. A jury will review all submitted entries, and the top 3 winners will receive prizes, and winning films will be shown at the Teen Film Festival premiere, which will take place on Wednesday, September 10th at Rincon Valley Regional Library. Teens seeking more information on festival submission guidelines can visit their local library or sonomalibrary.org/teenfilmmakers.
And now back to Strictly Business.
And we're back. You're listening to Strictly Business with today's guest, Doug Keene, who's the chef and co-owner of Cyrus Restaurant in Geyserville.
And again, Doug, thank you for joining us today. You were gracious in your responding to our having met at the Authors Festival in May, and I appreciate your being here with us today to talk about your book, Culinary Leverage, which is both a bit of catharsis, it would seem, as well as a blueprint for hopefully what could be and hopefully is a changing industry. I mean, the restaurant industry takes many shapes and forms, from drive-in McDonald's to Cyrus, to fine dining models. And you obviously know better than any of us how competitive a business it is and how difficult it is both to own and operate, let alone to work in that environment. And because of your work and because of your philosophy, I'm summarizing here, but Cyrus has become a case study for Harvard Business School, titled "Turning a Traditional Business Model on Its Head," to be more sustainable, employee focused, an innovative solution to how to structure a restaurant, a 4-day work week, higher wages, a different kind of a dining experience. Has it worked?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been amazing. How do you judge has it worked? There's probably a number of ways. Now, our turnover, people leaving us, has been really, really small. a couple people in the beginning, which kind of always happens when you open a restaurant. But for the most part, we've got a lot of the same crew we had 3 years ago. We're going to turn three on September 12th. We've made distributions. You know, this year, obviously, business is down, so we're being pretty close on it. The model is also adjustable, right? When business drops, we could go down to less bodies and do less covers and still work. It's about finding that, but it's also about not losing the potential to make money when there's money out there for us. So you kind of have to run that back and forth in your head as to like how many staff do you keep if business does drop. But we also built this knowing that we could do events, and events are a huge profit margin, and events are a big part of the business. People come to Sonoma County to do events, and so we are actively pursuing that piece of the pie. We've done a bunch of events. We want to even do more because the bottom line is greatly affected by special events, and they're easier to do. You know, 48 people a night, 12, four seatings of 12 with all these little intricate dishes is fun and tedious and hard and exhausting. Doing 100 people for three courses, where you can bring in $100,000 or close to it, probably a little bit less than that, but it's like, okay. So if you can run the right balance, that's the long-term goal, where you can do the fun stuff but still have another model on the catering side. So yeah, it does work, and it's a dream come true. Be careful what you wish for. It might happen sometimes.
You know, I was also impressed with your trip to Japan and your being influenced by what you saw in restaurants and kitchens in Japan. A concept, if I'm correct here, called shibumi. Refined simplicity, if you will. Elegant flavors. Quiet perfection. I was struck by that because down the road in Healdsburg, your colleagues at Single Thread talk a lot about another concept called Kayocho, I guess it's pronounced, which is guest research, honoring people as high-ranking officials, and they want to make them feel special, in other words. So I'm struck by both of your restaurants being starred restaurants and operating with a Japanese underlying theme. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in kitchens in Manhattan, and also when I came out here to San Francisco, and the model was, if you weren't in the weeds, if you weren't pushing as hard as you possibly can and sweating and barely keeping alive, you weren't doing good work. And that's all that I knew, that energy, that high testosterone, high energy, exhausting, almost addicting, and then you need a beer or something else to come down at the end of the night. It's this vicious cycle, but you thrive off of it. When I went to Japan for a month on a scholarship, I noticed like I would eat in these restaurants and it was just magical. It was some of the best food I'd ever had in my life consistently. And then I would work in the same kitchens, because that was part of the scholarship, is you would, you know, go eat, go study, go travel and shop, and then go work. And it was quiet, thoughtful, engineered. And the food was just as good. Like some of the, like in New York, like at L'Espinasse, Chef Koons was famous for like 10 pan pickups, meaning if I was the entremetier, I would have six to seven pans of garnishes, veg, things that all had to make it up onto this dish. My meat guy, the guy cooking the meat, would have two or three. He'd have a saucier as well. So the meat guy would have a meat and a topping, maybe something, and then the saucier. So there was 10 things coming up to make one plate. And you were, shit, I can't make it, you know. But then you're doing the next one. And I realized in Japan that wasn't like it. They were finishing dishes like – everything would be done. There would be maybe like 9 or 10 components, but they were already on the plate. Some were warm, some were room temp, some were cold. And then you would finish. You would sear the fish or fry the tempura or grill the rib or whatever it is. And there was like one or two steps at the end. And I was like, whoa. I'm like, this is, and there was no noise. And they worked really hard and they put out great food. And I was like, I need this. I don't want to feel like this every night. And so I wanted to feel like that in Japan every night. I didn't want to feel like I was feeling for the last 20 years of my career. And so I came back and started to try to implement changes at the first Cyrus. Somewhat successful, but what I learned is changing culture in the middle is really, really hard. Because all of a sudden you're just trying to have people like reprogrammed. And if they're not getting pushed and in the weeds, they don't think they're doing enough. They're like, oh, this isn't hard enough, you know? And I'm like, well, our food just got higher rated by whoever the supposedly the experts are, and we're doing it easier. So maybe we're doing something right. But I got it. And so when I started this restaurant, it was a philosophy that we imparted on everyone, and we were very, very adamant and steadfast about setting the culture. And here's what the culture is, and we're not going to bend on certain things. And so we talked to people for 3 hours before we hired them, like three different times, made sure they understood the concept, made sure they understood what the kitchen life was like, and they bought in. And that was the by far and away the most important thing we did was set the culture, and now it perpetuates itself.
I would imagine you were disappointed when your Japanese influenced steakhouse in Healdsburg didn't make it, Shimo. I was disappointed. I would have gone. But was that a real downer for you, I assume?
Yeah, it was a real downer. There was a lot of love in that restaurant. The food was phenomenal. I was not the chef. I was the owner. Colin Vasilier was the chef. It was a really fun concept ahead of its time. It was loosely based off of Peter Luger's in New York, where you buy a big piece of protein and share it, and it's like the best it can be. It was just too chefy and too complicated for people wanted their strip loin and their mashed potatoes. And we probably would have been successful, but it wasn't in my cards. I didn't want to do anything that boring. I wanted to do fun things. And then we turned it into more of a ramen place towards the end. And that was doing really well, except for the profit margin was 2%. And I just didn't want to be in business for 2%. So, yeah, there was a labor of love. It's funny. For the 10 years after we closed that, before this opened, people were saying, oh, my God, bring that back. Bring Shimo back. We love it. And I'm like, I would have made more money. I would have lost less money if I stood outside and gave you $10 not to come in. It just wasn't going to happen. But maybe someone will do a ramen place in town, and I'll be the first one to go to it.
I know that one of your management themes in Cyrus 2.0 is cross-training of the employees, which ultimately winds up being, if I understand this correctly, kind of both shared experiences and shared tips. Did that come from your own experience in New York after Cornell, when you were trying to learn as much as you could, as fast as you can, and you would do anything that was required of you to be able to get things done?
No, that's interesting. Maybe it was rooted there. What it came to me was just the dysfunction of how many people the business had and how low they were paid and how to fix that. You come at it from a different angles, like saying, how many people can we actually afford to have if we're going to pay them this much? Okay, we can only have 22 people. Okay, so now how do we engineer this experience? All right, you take certain steps out, like tablecloths, and you do one great bread versus 10 great breads. But then it's like the other aspect that always bothered me was that there are waves in a restaurant. There are waves like when the guests come in, the waiters are busy, and then when all the orders hit, the kitchen is busy. And then you need runners, and there's always pinch points, and people have their specific jobs. The dishwashers get slammed after you clear the first seating or whatever. No one's helping each other because everyone has their specific role. And I'm like, wait a minute. If four of us go knock out the dish area for 15 minutes, they won't be. And when those guys aren't busy, when they're sitting there in the first hour, maybe they can help change tables. They can clear some stuff. So it's about getting everyone to help do each other's jobs so that we didn't need more people. Like that, your job is just to food run, only to food run. That's all you do all night. So when there's no food to run, what are you doing? You know, and that happens a lot with cooks. As soon as when the cook cooks the risotto or whatever, sears the piece of foie gras, and they're sitting there waiting for a runner because they've just ran six other tables, and those runners, it's like, why didn't the cook just take it? He's got nothing else to do for a few minutes. Why can't he run to the table? He knows the food better than anyone. He made it. How fun. It's the fastest way to get it there. It's not feasible to do all that because they're cooking things and cooking things constantly. But the way we engineered it, 12 people at a time, we have kind of phases of this. And so we are able to do a lot of that. And it works great. And the fun part is there's an intrinsic reward that I didn't understand was going to happen. But when you are a cook and you made a dish and you get to run it to a guest in the dining room – and you get to see their face and how happy they are, there is something you come back with a sense of pride, even more so if you just know you did a good job. You actually get that connection to the person you're cooking for, which is, to me, what hospitality is all about.
Well said. I mean, I always considered fine dining, which I would I historically would equate to high priced, as being a very special occasion. When I lived in New York, and on my anniversary, I would go to a restaurant which you may recall, which doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately, called Chanterelle, which was the number one restaurant for service and the number four restaurant for stars and food. And it was just so nicely done. It was just such a pleasant experience. And I consider myself a basic schnook with a capital S, and I could only appreciate the creativity brought to a table. And I still feel that way. I think it's amazing what people can do. And in fact, it raises another interesting distinction between West and East, which I hadn't thought of until reading your book, was that, and this probably starts with Alice Waters, but the point is made in the book that Western preparation is so involved in ingredients, and you make this point about Sonoma County, the freshness of the ingredients, the seasonality of ingredients, whereas the East Coast seems to dwell more in technique. I thought that was an interesting distinction.
Very much the case from my experience when I was in New York, that season. I mean, we use tomatoes all year long at Las Penas, right? You come out here and it's like, you got them on the menu after like Halloween, unless it's a hot spell, people are looking at you kind of weird. And if you got certain peaches on after their season goes out, you're like, oh God. So it was a hyper seasonality. The product here is by far and away the best in the world, the produce. And so you are just blessed to work here. So if you don't follow that ethos, did it start with Alice? It might have. She definitely brought it to the forefront to think about locality and seasonality. But I think it's been embraced by quite a few people to the point where when I came out here, it was kind of frustrating because it was all just about that. And there was very little technique that impressed me. But now I think San Francisco and L.A. even are so far above the East Coast as far as the technique and the ingredients being combined that the food world, it's finally got – this is the capital of cooking in America, in my opinion.
Interesting. My clock is telling me that I have a big mouth and I have to stop using it. But let me ask you this last question, Doug, and that is from a patron's perspective, from a diner's perspective – in the hope that there, especially after reading your book, that there would be greater awareness of how the model can work and make life better both for you, for your workers, and for those who get served. What can patrons do to help the model succeed? Is there anything that we can do?
Show up for your reservations. People will make a number of reservations sometimes and just because they're not sure where they want to go. That is a death knell. We had to implement a policy. We booked through Talk because we would have a six top not show up, and that is your profit. Even if you have a deposit, we take a full deposit for the full ticket, but we're not selling. We need to sell beverages too, right? So when you don't show, we're still not making that sale. That's a big deal, especially when you're only doing 36 or 48 people a night. 5 to 10% of your guests don't show up. That's brutal. Yeah. Be respectful about your likes and dislikes. If you're going to a tasting menu and you don't love eggplant, eat the eggplant. don't go to a tasting menu if you're that picky.
Right.
You'll go to an a la carte restaurant and order exactly what you want.
Right.
And I think the most important thing is voice your displeasure if you don't like something. You cannot like something. It doesn't mean it's bad, right? I can cook it perfectly and you don't like something, but it's also good to know, sometimes it doesn't happen as much now, but we would get complaints, not complaints, but people would say it was too salty or something the first Cyrus. And it wasn't the salt, it was the acid level that we used. And so I would bring it back down. I would be able to adjust it, but adjust it in the moment. Let me know you're having an issue during the moment. Versus going and yelping about it or getting angry. We'd love to fix it for you and make you have a great evening.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it, and we wish you the best with Cyrus and hopefully other restaurants you'll open or books you'll write. But it's a pleasure to have had
you. Right. I don't know if I got a lot of restaurants in me, but books, I wouldn't mind writing a book or two.
Well, thanks for joining us, and it was a pleasure to talk to you as well as to read the book. Thanks a lot for being with
us. Thanks for having me. I appreciate your time.
Yours too.
Doug, it's been a real pleasure having you on the show today. You've been listening to Strictly Business with today's guest, Doug Keene, who's the chef and co-owner of Cyrus Restaurant in Geyserville. Strictly Business will be back again next Monday at 1 p.m. But in the meantime, you can follow our podcast on Spotify at Strictly Business, KSVY, where you can find this interview as well as all of our past interviews. And that does it for us today. So on behalf of our host, Kip Altman. This is Scott Hunter wishing you a peaceful and successful week ahead.